It's really a tremendous pleasure to speak about Cynthia Ozick. Unlike some of the other New York intellectuals that we've been reading and talking about, she is still very much with us, productive as ever. She has published 7 novels, 5 collections of stories, 7 volumes of essays, a play, much more that is not yet in book form. I would say that her correspondence, which has not yet been collected, will equal in literary importance that of the great letter writers in the great age of letter writing, the 18th and 19th centuries. Ozick is a stunningly original writer of fiction and a foremost intellectual. As against, you know, the tight-lipped minimalists, one could call her a literary maximalist. She's a writer and a thinker to feast on, with language and imagination to spare. About a decade younger than the New York intellectuals that we've been talking about, she was not really part of their circle, but she certainly built on their work in fashioning her own. And since I can only hope to introduce a very small part of her huge accomplishment, I'm going to focus on primarily the writer of ideas. So Ozick was born in New York City in 1928, raised in the Bronx by immigrant parents who ran a local pharmacy that would not carry Bayer aspirin because it was made in Germany. She had a limited formal Jewish education, but was raised in a highly cultured, strongly Zionist family. Her mother's brother was Avraham Regelson, an American Hebrew poet who moved to Israel. So that the presence in the family of one professional writer may have made her own choice of career that much more acceptable. She was educated at Hunter College High School, at NYU, and at Ohio State University, and then spent almost a decade writing large-scale novels before she developed the kind of writing and addressed the kind of subjects that we now associate with her name. In the late 1960s, she began publishing stories, shorter novels, and essays, moving back and forth between these two genres, fiction and essay. Always insistent on the need for artistic independence, she wrote fiction on Jewish subjects, literary essays and criticism about Jewish literature. She's a fearsome champion of Israel and brilliant foe of all those who threaten it. There are very few modern authors of her stature who lived and thought so completely as a Jew while writing in a non-Jewish language. So it took Cynthia Ozick until her late 30s to emerge from what she describes as an extended self-imposed apprenticeship to the great early 20th century American novelist Henry James, the author of The Golden Bowl, Portrait of a Lady, Washington Square, to name only some of the works of his that have already been made into film. She was drawn to, and I quote here, the worldliness of his characters, the visual brilliance of his long scenes, the seductiveness of his betrayals, the veiled innocence of his young women, the subtlety of his moral conundrums, and not least, his debt to human possibility and also to human taint. If you are going to choose a master, she chose well. The term consciousness raising, sometimes associated with drugs, best describes the way a James novel awakens us to the nuance of human behavior and the refinement of moral distinctions. Her literary model, I think, is what differentiates her from the recently deceased Herman Woke, another very talented, very Jewish American writer who is closer to social novelists like Theodore Dreiser or Sinclair Lewis. Woke tells engrossing and important stories about recognizable people in familiar situations. Now, Ozick developed her own form of fiction that encourages the emergence of a new kind of reader. Woke tries to resolve the problems that his stories introduce. Ozick's brainy writing exposes problems we didn't realize that we had. So I'll try to illustrate this with one story, with the title story of her first book of fiction. The book is called The Pagan Rabbi. The story is called The Pagan Rabbi. And it's preceded by a rabbinic epigraph from the Ethics of the Fathers. Rabbi Jacob said, "He who is walking along and studying, but then breaks off to remark, 'How lovely is that tree,' or 'How beautiful is that fallow field,' Scripture regards such a one as having hurt his own being." Now, with this quotation, Cynthia Ozick was joining over a century of Jewish debate. The Jewish Enlightenment, the Haskalah of Eastern Europe, had set up a dichotomy between rabbinic study and nature, between the calling of the Torah and the call of the wild. It saw itself as a corrective to the repressed intellectualism of the scholars, and it took the side of the student who does break away from his studies to admire beauty. It spoke for those who wanted to bring the denatured Jews closer to the natural world. The Hebrew writer Mika Yosef Berdichevsky argued that God is actually present in nature, but the Talmudic way of life prevents Jews from appreciating his presence. A century later, in America, the conditions had flipped. The yeshiva culture of the Jews had given way to the flower children of the 60s. Milton Himmelfarb, whom we discussed in an earlier lecture, warned against the epidemic of drugs and sexual hedonism, which he called the paganism that was sweeping America. The environmental movement argued that nature was perfect and human beings were its defilers. So in this story, Ozick dares to bring us an actual Jewish embrace of paganism. It begins like this. "When I heard that Isaac Kornfeld, a man of piety and brains, had hanged himself in the public park, I put a token in the subway stile and journeyed out to see the tree." The man telling this story was once Kornfeld's closest friend. They were both the sons of rabbis. Our narrator was the lesser of the two. He became a mere bookseller, and he married a Gentile. His father sat shiva for him and never reconciled with him. The marriage ended in divorce. Isaac, on the other hand, was the complete Jewish success, who became a brilliant rabbinic authority, husband and father of seven daughters, and a source of pride, tremendous pride, to his father. So what went wrong? Why did he hang himself? After inspecting the site of the suicide, a place called Trillam's Inlet, our narrator visits Kornfeld's widow, Shandel, who overcomes her initial reluctance to discuss her husband's death and shares with him a letter that her husband left by way of self-explanation. They read it together for 13 of the story's 34 pages. Right? 13 of the 34 pages of the story is taken up by this letter left by Isaac. His message is, and this is from his letter, "It is false history, false philosophy, and false religion which declare to us human ones that we live among things. The arts of physics and chemistry begin to teach us differently, but their way of compassion is new and finds few to carry fidelity to its logical and beautiful end. The molecules dance inside all forms, and within the molecules dance the atoms, and within the atoms dance still profounder sources of divine vitality. There is nothing that is dead. There is no non-life. Holy life subsists even in the stone, even in the bones of dead dogs and dead men. Hence, in God's fecunditating creation, there is no possibility of idolatry, and therefore no possibility of committing this so-called abomination." So Isaac's letter is part explanation, part love letter, explaining, recounting his passionate attraction to a creature he calls the tree nymph. Indeed, the letter is addressed not to his wife, Shandel, but to loveliness, the seductive spirit of the tree. He has wrapped the talus around his neck to hang himself from her branch. The word midrash is often overused nowadays for stories that apply biblical or ancient motifs to contemporary situations. But Ozick's story is clearly meant to be read as a midrash on a midrash, since her epigraph connects Isaac Kornfeld, note the name Kornfield, to the Jew who breaks off from his studies to admire nature. Now we know what the Talmud's Rabbi Jacob was actually warning against. Nature is no mere distraction. It can be a ruling passion that competes with and triumphs over Judaism. The story marked a break with existing American Jewish fiction, and the reader's discomfort with it, and I think, you know, it's hard to read that story without some sense of discomfort, it's conveyed by the way the suicide's friend and widow read the letter. The narrator doesn't believe what he's hearing. Shandel is full of scorn and anger. How disgusting! She was born in a concentration camp and still bears the scar of having been tossed as an infant against the barbed wire fence. Is this what she had to live to see? Her husband committing an abomination that he claims is not an abomination? We readers may be just as uncomfortable as they are, but Isaac's letter compels us to take seriously this pagan rebellion against Judaism. And Ozick, the author, is also under suspicion. By putting the letter at the center of the story, she tells us that the imaginative writer may be the true idolatress. After all, why else would she have produced Isaac's document if not for the chance to enter into Isaac's spirit? Yes, the story warns us against him, just as the Midrash warns us not to be distracted by the lure of nature. But why warn against something unless you experience its dangers? The literary imagination has a strong antinomian streak. Ozick indulges that streak and maybe shares it in order the better to contend with it. Now, both friends in this story take a turn away from rabbinic Judaism, but note that the story plays up Isaac's love rather than the narrator's marriage to a Gentile. Intermarriage was the dominant subject of American Jewish fiction. Think of novels like Marjorie Morningstar and What Makes Sammy Run, of movies like The Jazz Singer and The Benny Goodman Story. Here, intermarriage is dwarfed by something more critical. What is usually dominant is here subordinate, almost irrelevant. And if that makes the story less realistic, well, that too is deliberate. Cynthia Ozick was after something bigger, bigger than social realism, something bigger than stories about chasing after money or shiksas, if you will forgive me, bigger even than intergenerational quarrels. She aspired to be a writer on the highest order of both literature and Jewish thought, and authentic Jewish culture would have to emerge from issues and tensions that have preoccupied Jews from their beginning. So in sum, the story is written from a religious perspective that was barely to be found in the actual Jewish community in the 1960s. The characters are steeped in the traditional Jewish way of life, and the story itself, headed by that passage from Pirkei Avot, is told in their cultural language. The assumptions of literary realism are stretched to include a highly improbable suicide, a highly improbable suicide letter, and an equally improbable social setting. There is no such place as Trillium's Inlet, and to my knowledge, no community that combined worldliness and Jewishness as these characters do. Professor Eva Brann of St. John's College puts it well, writing, quote, "No one in this story is lovable or even pleasant, not the runaway rabbi, not the bitter Rebbetzin, nor the bookseller who tells the tale, not even, or least of all, the rural spirit that seduces him. For in love battle with a Jew, the nymph proves to be a demon. But they are all reenacting an old and deadly serious antagonism, and thus they command respect." Ozick has invented a new form of fiction that follows from traditional halacha and Agada by combining the two, by combining the natural with the supernatural or storytelling with moral reasoning. She invented what one might call a new form of Jewish realism. And was she not prescient in anticipating that environmentalism could become the new American religion? Cynthia Ozick knew what she was doing, and she explains it better than I could. Soon after the publication of The Pagan Rabbi, in 1970, at the American Jewish Congress's American-Israel Dialogue that was held every 2 years to build cultural bridges between Jewish writers in Israel and abroad, she delivered a two-hour speech announcing a new stage in American Jewish culture. I have and have never given up the copy of Judaism, Summer 1970, where this talk was published in its entirety, and you can find it in her collection, Art and Ardor. So this speech began by addressing what the European intellectual George Steiner had said at a previous dialogue. He had said that the essential Jew was the Jew of exile, and that the genius of the Jews derived from their homelessness. He had said homelessness is the virtue of being disarmed, and powerlessness has at least the power to slay without weaponry the serpent nationalism whose secret name is atavistic tribalism. Diaspora was at once a harrying, in Steiner's phrase, and a blessing, the great blessing of worldliness. In her response, Ozick emphasizes that universalism was, of course, a Jewish impulse, but not as Steiner conceived it. If Jews were displaced from their homeland and prevented from returning to it, their displacement was not the basis of their civilization. It was merely the response to enemies who had driven them from their country and from other countries where they had settled for a time. And she says, the Jewish universalism emphasizes that the God of Israel is also the God of mankind in general. It does not claim that the God of mankind in general must be the God of Israel. To celebrate what the harrying of diaspora does for the Jew, somehow also to tolerate the harrying. You cannot praise the consequence with some of your praise sticking to its brute instrumentality. In short, even if diaspora is credited with begetting or reinforcing the universalistic mentality, it remains a perverse criterion. It has to be chewed, but this is extraordinary. And so much for Steiner. I don't think one can ever think of, you know, Jewish universalism that way. And then she dispatched Philip Roth, who at an earlier conference said that he didn't want to be considered a Jewish writer. Also, the poet Allen Ginsberg, who spoke for the New Left and for Yippies and a lifestyle that he called psychedelic consciousness. And also, she was against the new literary gatekeepers who said that 19th century novel was dead and that fiction was simply expected to be, not to mean anything. With dazzling force, she condemned every trendy notion that was drawing Jewish writers into its orbit. And she writes, "Diaspora flattery is our pustule, culture envy our infection. Not only do we flatter Gentiles, we crave their flattery. We crave the flattery of Gentiles, and often in America we receive it." She mocks all the de-Judaized novelists and rabbis and critics. But there's more. This gargantuan cleanup operation was just clearing the ground for the new American Jewish culture that was about to replace it. Yavne, she explained, was the place where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and his students had established an academy outside Jerusalem. And it was out of Yavne that learning became an instrument of Jewish restoration. Now, American Jews were not yet ingathered into the state of Israel, and therefore the diaspora that they were building was a new Yavne. Their cultural regeneration would be more modest than what was happening in Israel, just as Yiddish, for all its power, remained second to Hebrew. In parallel fashion, one could say that American Jews were creating a new Yiddish. In fact, said Ozick, we are already speaking this new language. I am speaking it now, she said. You are hearing it now. The English vernacular is on its way toward becoming Jewish. Now, we are told that this talk electrified its listeners, and one can certainly see why. I don't think that another claim as bold, as brilliantly articulated or inspiring has ever been made for American Jewish culture before or since. And she had reserved the best for the last to convey her idea of this new Jewish liturgical literature. She offered the enchanting image of the shofar, the ancient Jewish instrument that still plays such an important part in Jewish liturgy. She says, if we blow into the narrow end of the shofar, we will be heard far. But if we choose to be mankind rather than Jewish and blow into the wider part, we will not be heard at all. For us, America will have been in vain. Even if one cannot pin down its exact meaning, we know that this means going outward from the particular to the universal, emerging from Jewish history and sources and experience, treating English as a vehicle for the spread of Jewishness. Cynthia Ozick was both the prophet and the practitioner of this new language in what was to become our new Yavne. Now, the Jewish Academy of Yavne was founded after the destruction of Jerusalem by the Romans, and any genuine diaspora Jewish culture in America after the Second World War had to grapple with that national catastrophe. If Jews intended to make another stab at creative survival outside their homeland, they had better know how to relate to the Shoah. Ozick never stops thinking about this. Isaac Kornfeld commits suicide over nature. The Italian Jewish writer Primo Levi committed suicide over Auschwitz. He was not the only one, but she does not give her fellow Jewish writers a pass for having experienced the horrors of the death camp. And she certainly does not use Auschwitz as any kind of teaching tool. Rather, she is afraid that Auschwitz is being fetishized and is in danger of displacing Judaism as the basis for moral instruction. Her every essay or work of this fiction, of fiction on this subject, and there are quite a number of them, every one of them sounds a warning of one kind or another. So Primo Levi's suicide note is an essay review of his final book, The Drowned and the Saved, written 40 years after his survival of Auschwitz and his return to Italy, and 3 years before he threw himself down the stairwell of his home to his death. Now, some claim that this fall was accidental, but Ozick's essay applies regardless. She takes up an argument of Primo Levi's with another survivor of Auschwitz with whom he began corresponding after the war, the Austrian philosopher Hans Mayer, who wrote under the pseudonym of Jean Améry. Améry had committed suicide in 1978, and Levi polemicizes with the dead man, troubled by how they differ. Améry had written in anger and was proud of his anger. He described having been punched in the face by a Polish thug in the camp and how he had punched him back. He was ruthlessly beaten for this, but hurting all over from the blows, he says, I was satisfied with myself. Améry had referred to Levi, on the other hand, as the forgiver, obviously not intending it as a compliment. Now, Primo Levi denied that he forgave the Germans, but he wrote that he personally was unable to return punches or trade blows, And he wonders whether those who trade blows with the world are not certain to be defeated. He asks whether Amery's rage may not have led to his self-destruction. Ozick cannot let this pass. She sides with the fighter. She says Levy, who was by profession a chemist, maintained a scientist's temperament as a writer. This is how she puts it. Levy has kept his distance from blaming, scolding, insisting, vilifying, lamenting, crying out. His method has been to describe meticulously, analytically, clarifyingly. He has been a Darwin of the death camps. Many readers appreciated, loved this aura of objectivity, and they were pleased that Primo Levi absolves, or rather mutes, the question of absolution. She writes, "The advantage for many of Levi's readers has been, dare one say this, a curious peacefulness, the consequence of his famous detachment." Now, Cynthia Ozick does not believe the connection he made between rage and self-destruction, and she proposes that all the time Levy was just holding back, and that eventually he would have to erupt to catch up after decades of abstaining. "I grieve," writes Ozick, "I grieve that he equated rage with self-destruction, a flawed formula." And she inverts the connection he tried to make between trading blows and suicide, and thinks that Levy may have held back for too long. She takes up the polemic with a dead man because there is too much at stake to leave this unresolved. To forgive evil is not morality, and detachment is not an appropriate response to Auschwitz. Now, the images of the survivor that Ozick offers in her fiction are far removed from that of Primo Levi. Her most famous work on the subject, The Shawl, is a story of a mother with her suckling child and a niece of 14 on a forced march to the death camp, where only two of the three survive. Rosa, the mother, wraps her 18-month daughter Magda in a shawl that seems to give the child more sucking nourishment than her dried breasts can provide. Stella, the niece, who is desperate with cold, takes the shawl away from the child, and the bereft little one runs out into the yard crying, "Ma," which is the first sound that she has ever uttered. Rosa had been able to keep the child hidden because until this point, the little one had been mute. Should Rosa now run after her, she will not be able to calm her without the shawl. And if she goes back for the shawl, she will be too late to save her daughter. She is in any case too late. A camp guard picks the child up and hurls her against the electric fence. So she took Magda's shawl and stuffed her own mouth with it, stuffed it in until she was tasting the cinnamon and almond depth of Magda's saliva. And Rosa drank Magda's shawl until it dried. Just how that story ends. Though Rosa is in fact a snobbishly assimilated Polish Jew, Ozick gives the shawl a taste of the rozinkes mit mandlen, the raisins and almonds of the best known Jewish lullaby. That mother's choked outcry against the murder of her only child is Cynthia Ozick's stifled outcry on the mother's behalf. But she couldn't leave it at that. So 3 years later, she published a sequel to this story about Rosa that takes place 30 years after the war. Rosa Lublin, a mad woman and scavenger, gave up her store, she smashed it herself, and moved to Miami. I dare anyone to try to sympathize with this bitter, vindictive woman who treats Stella, her niece, as her daughter's killer, yet continues to take money from her. Rosa considers herself too good for America, let alone for its Jews, and communicates solely with her dead daughter, Magda, in Polish, of course, whom she continues to imagine at every step of her development as the pure-blooded, aristocratic Pole that she herself would have wanted to be. Rosa is not a pitiable casualty of the Holocaust, but a smasher of idols who is herself an idolatress, worshiping her absent child. Her disgust with her surroundings allows for a scathing portrait of Miami, depicted by Ozick as a Jewish wasteland. I have so far not spoken of how wickedly funny she can be. Enter a social scientist, Dr. James W. Tree, who wants to interview Rosa for a project about survivors based on earlier research on repressed animation, a theory of the biological ground of survival. And he sends her this work, suggesting that she read especially chapter 6, Defensive Group Formation, The Way of the Baboons. You can imagine how this inspires this woman, right? It is pure fun to see Rosa verbally demolishing his research the way she did her store. But she herself is also an object of Ozick's satire. Rosa worships the shawl just the way some Christians worship the shroud of Jesus. This remarkable work shows how some perverse responses to Hitler's war against the Jews may now destroy Judaism no less decisively than the war did. Those two responses being Rosa's kind and Dr. Tree's kind. Two very different, opposite kinds of responses of worship and analysis, both terribly wrong. So Cynthia Ozick's writing was by no means limited to Jewish concerns, and her growing prominence won her invitations to write and speak on many other subjects. T.S. Eliot, Henry James, Dostoevsky, and Salman Rushdie, E.M. Forster, Truman Capote, Edith Wharton, Virginia Woolf are only some of the dozens of writers that she wrote about. And if she also concentrated on the major Jewish authors, Isaac Babel, Saul Bellow, Franz Kafka, S.Y. Agnon, that was only natural, given that these subjects were close to home. Some considered it parochial of her, in the sense of narrow and insular, when she picked out the Jewish thread in a more general subject. But she flicked off that objection with one of her most important observations. Universalism is the parochialism of the Jews. This was more than a clever turn of phrase. Judaism is so central to the development of Western civilization. The Jewish people is so prominent in the history of the world. Jewish thinking and experience are often so much more interesting than that of the surrounding nations, that writers betray a pitiable insecurity and a shrunken sense of proportion when they reach for what they think is bigger than the Jewishness into which they were born. She mocks their pettiness in some of her work, and elsewhere she shows how the Jewish thread in a subject is sometimes what holds it together. Her security as a Jew translated into her security as a writer, so that she kept taking chances in her choice of form and subject. The photographs of Ozick, we're blessed to have one, invariably show a sweet, smiling girl with bangs on her forehead touching the top of her glasses. Reports of her undramatic life in New Rochelle, family, community, hard nightly work, first at a typewriter and then at a computer, these bespeak a thoroughly bourgeois artist. It is therefore the more surprising to find a keen, adventurous mind that is never mean but unsparing to those who earn her scorn. Her essays about other writers are as vivid as her stories because she approaches them from the inside, understands them deeply, and reveals something new about each and every one of them. She resists feminist parochialism in the same way that she resists Jewish parochialism. The book of Genesis tells us, male and female, he created them, and the imaginative writer is equally free to create and speak for both sexes. She dares to conjure up writers as dissimilar as the Yiddish writer Isaac Bashevis Singer, the Polish writer Jerzy Kosinski, the deaf and dumb Helen Keller. our conventional wife and mother is a breakthrough artist, but then Ozick reminds us again and again to look at writers only through their writing, not through the buzz about their lives. As a writer, I think she strides the world, the literary world, like a colossus. So let me offer one final example of this. In her commentary essay about Mrs. Virginia Woolf, written as a review of the 1973 biography by Woolf's nephew, her sister's son, Quentin Bell. Virginia Woolf, probably know, was a central figure of perhaps the most famous literary group of the century, the British Bloomsbury Circle, composed of a small set of young men who had met at Cambridge University, and the two Stephen sisters, Vanessa and Virginia, who were the young men's sisters, mistresses, and wives. And if this doesn't quite add up, you have to use your imagination. The members of Bloomsbury wrote well enough and were well enough written about to become the touchstone of cultural modernity. So Quentin Bell, Virginia's nephew, was of that world. Cynthia Ozick was of New Rochelle. With genuine chutzpah and the talent to carry it off, she set out to rescue Virginia from her biographer and from the taint of madness with which she is always associated. In performing this rescue, she seemed to be imitating Virginia's Jewish husband, Leonard Woolf, who acted as, in effect, her nurse, and who tried to rescue his wife from her spells of despair. But Ozick was also rehabilitating the husband. The review essay captures the excitement of Bloomsbury, some of its genius, and genuine claim to fame. But following a Jewish thread, she picks out the core of its achievement. Some have interpreted Leonard Woolf's marriage to Virginia Stephen, the sister of his Cambridge schoolmate, as an archetype of assimilation. Ozick sees it as a mutual salvation in a common cause. When he married her, the Jew, Leonard Woolf, did not know how sick Virginia really was, but by taking over the care for her, he freed the rest of the family and did everything he could to keep her steady and able to work. This is how Ozick describes this. He was fit for her because her madness, especially in combination with her innovative genius, demanded the most grave, minutely persevering, and attentive service. She was fit for him not simply because she represented Bloomsbury in its most resplendent flowering of originality and luminousness. What Leonard needed in Virginia was not so much her genius as her madness. It made possible for him the exercise of the one thing Bloomsbury had no use for, uxoriousness, the attentiveness of the husband to the wife. It allowed him the tonality of his seriousness unchecked. It gave it legitimate occupation. It made it both necessary and awesome. Leonard Woolf also created, this is now after the quotation, Leonard Woolf also created and ran the Hogarth Press, resisting the anti-Jewish prejudice of British upper classes. Questions always swirled around them. Was Virginia really a lesbian? Was he a cultural social climber? Ozick takes up all these questions and more, but emphasizes the literary outcome of their union. T.S. Eliot, another voice of English modernism, had written, "The rats are underneath the piles, the Jew is underneath the lot." But here, the Jew was the sustaining pillar of Bloomsbury's high art. So Ozick also insists on seeing Virginia not as a madwoman or a psychoanalytical project, but as a great writer. She writes, "A writer's heroism is in the act of writing, not in the finished work, but in the work as it goes." Ozick ends this essay on a note of triumph. Virginia's heroism was to keep her writing going. Leonard's heroism was to ensure that she could. Ozick's was to insist on the heroic task of literature and all the many ways that Jews serve it. So if anyone could have created Yavne on the shores of the Hudson, it was she. But the reader needs a sustaining audience. And this is where we come in, because we are here to see whether she was right. Thank you. It was very important in his thinking about America. Anti-Semitism was the monstrous destroyer of civilization in Europe, but America had gone to war to defeat fascism in Europe, and he did not want the anti-Jewish bigotry of someone like Albee to be mistaken for murderous Hitlerism, the he there being Bellow.